Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
You're listening to the National Security Podcast, the show that brings you expert analysis, insights, and opinion on the national security challenges facing Australia and the Indo-Pacific. Produced by the ANU National Security College.
This podcast was recorded in front of a live audience at the Australian National Gallery as part of the ANU National Security College's annual Women in National Security event. The college's Women in National Security program showcases and celebrates the contribution women make to the national security community. Enjoy.
I'd like to welcome you all officially to our podcast recording. As Caroline said, my name is Olivia and I'm one of the directors at the college and an occasional host of our podcast series. Today's podcast is being recorded on the lands of the Ngunnawal and Ngambri people, and we pay our respects to their elders, past and present. I'm delighted today to be joined by three fantastic guests, and I'll just introduce them briefly, and I think throughout the course of our questions from myself and from our audience, we'll get to know a little bit more about them. The first is Kimberly Brennan. She is a partner at Ernst & Young and Olympic medalist in rowing. She has this fantastic background that marries her interest in technology, consulting, and in intellectual property law with her sporting career, which has seen her take on some really major clients and some challenging projects in her role now as a consultant and really trying to energize and grow high-performing businesses and projects. The next person I want to invite, welcome, is Catherine. Catherine McMullen is the director of the Australian Geospatial Intelligence Organisation and a former First Assistant Director General at the Office of National Intelligence. Catherine comes from a long, long career in the national intelligence community. I'm really delighted to have her here and talk about the capability that she is now trying to grow in her role at AGO. My apologies. And then finally, we have Nunu Nguyen. Nunu is a Sir Roland Wilson Scholar, currently on leave from her regular day job as an Assistant Secretary in Treasury while she completes her PhD in economics. Nunu has been head of a macroeconomic analyst in a number of really high-profile roles in public and private sector, including BHP in Singapore and for the World Bank in Washington, D.C. So I'm really delighted to have these three amazing women on the panel today that come from a lot of different range of roles throughout their careers, but also a range of different sectors from sort of more traditional national intelligence, national security community to the private sector, to academia and research. So please join me in welcoming Kim, Catherine and Nunu. Now, Caroline and Gay sort of introduced the theme a little bit for the podcast series already, but I just wanted to give a brief intro into how we conceptualise this event and today's podcast. The theme for today's podcast is change. Changes that we've witnessed, changes that we're living through, and the changes we want to shape for the future. And it seems almost an aphorism to say that the world is going through enormous change. Politically, socially, economic, demographic, technological, environmental. We seem to daily read about seismic shifts in almost every arena. And often these shifts are accompanied by this claim that the pace and scale of change that we're witnessing is unprecedented. And because the changes and challenges we face really are big, it can sometimes even feel a bit overwhelming. It means that change will test our courage and our leadership, both for ourselves, for our organisations, for the national security community writ large, and for the national interest writ large. So on today's podcast, I'm going to ask our guests, with their wealth of experience across many disciplines, how they have navigated changes that are both personal and professional. I'm going to start with a question that's sort of about the past, but drawing the past into what we want to see for the future. And I think one of the things we often forget about change is that even when we go through change fatigue, a lot of what we experience is shaped by past events. And there are histories, lessons that we often forget or learn too late. So I want to start with you, Kim. Can you please share a moment of change that you've witnessed or that you've been a part of? What was integral for this change and what was the outcome?
Absolutely, and thank you for having me today. It's a huge honour to be here. I'm going to take you back to a time well before I was a part of the national security community and well before I'd moved into the world of consulting. I'm going to take you back to 3 years into my rowing career. Now, my shift into rowing was one that was brought about by adversity. So I was an aspiring track and field athlete. Really, everything to me was going to the Olympic Games. And then I suffered a series of foot injuries that meant I had to retire from running and found myself in a boat. And that's not actually the point of this story, because for the first couple of years of being a rower, the journey was amazingly fun. And the reason for that was, when you start something new, and for people here who have started a new job, when you're learning something and you're improving consistently, it's a really satisfying feeling. So my early years in rowing, of going out for each session and getting better results, had been really fulfilling. I had great early results. About a year into my rowing career, I won a medal at the World Championships. The following year was even better. And then the third year was the Beijing Olympic Games. And we went into those Olympic Games with really high hopes. We performed really well in the lead up. And we honestly believed that we'd done the work. We'd done everything right. We'd done what our coaches had asked of us. And we thought we were genuine contenders to perform well at those games. As it turned out, we actually came last. And that is, so it wasn't just that we hadn't made the podium, but we had significantly underperformed what we'd hoped we could achieve. And I think back to that time, and the story that I told myself at that time, and I think there was a self-protective mechanism in it, but a lot of the story I told myself was around being hard done by. You know, I had a narrative around, you know, I had gone in injured, and that was because things had happened to me. I felt that we were overtrained because our coach hadn't read the situation properly. I felt that, you know, they hadn't selected the right crews and done the right things. And that was a narrative that was really reinforced by the people around me as well. And I think a number of people this will resonate with. When something shit happens, we often rally around people and we say, don't worry, it's not you. You know, you're wonderful, you're great. That's so unfair that happened. And, you know, it's that person's fault or that person's fault. And we try to make people feel better by telling them it wasn't them. A year later, I had a similarly poor result at the World Championships. And shortly after that, had a really confronting, honest conversation with my coach. And I think that was the first time the light bulb properly went off, that the spotlight was put on me and my role in this. And it's incredibly, incredibly uncomfortable to be faced with the fact that you've made mistakes, you've done things wrong, you've failed at things that really mattered to you. Hadn't communicated as well as I should have. I hadn't taken responsibility for the things that I should have. I wasn't as fit as I hoped to be. I didn't concentrate as well as I wanted to. That hurts. But actually, confronting that discomfort and sitting there and being there and saying, you know what? I'm not perfect. I'm flawed and I'm working on it was really empowering because that gave me the ability to really work on everything that would make me a better person, a better leader, a better rower, a better teammate. And having that spotlight has been something that has been a really critical learning for me that shaped the athlete I became, but also in my professional life of being willing to really take responsibility for mistakes and also make sure that the teams that I'm a part of, I offer the same generosity of forgiveness and learning to the people around me, because I think sometimes we have a tendency to create quite a binary view. People are good or bad, you know, a mistake makes you bad. But the reality is, if you have that binary view, it's very hard to put that spotlight on yourself because everyone makes mistakes, everyone fails, and everyone can do better. And I think for me, that was a really critical point of change that has helped me turn up each day, particularly in a new world for me where I am an outsider again, to go, I don't know all the answers and I'm not going to get things right all the time, but I'm at least going to be honest with myself as to how I can do better each day.
Thank you so much for that story, Kim. I love how frank and honest you are about that, and certainly a huge thing that's been part of your life and has shaped your leadership. I think it's really pronounced when you talk about the pressure and the spotlight, because I'm sure that resonates with a lot of people in the room. But for you, that is a national spotlight. That is the Olympic Games. You are put out there, you know, and there's all that expectation on your shoulders. And to really carry that through and to grow from that and to become more resilient from that, like, I have a huge amount of admiration for that.
I think one of the interesting things that I did learn throughout my career, I used to think it was about not getting nervous. And I've realised that that's not right. You know, the emotions that we feel, we can't stop those emotions. What we can do, though, is work on how we respond to them. And one of the things leading into the Rio Olympics, so I knew I'd be going into the Olympic Games as the favourite, and I knew there was a lot of pressure on me to get this right. And I also knew from a personal point of view, I'd sacrificed a lot to be where I was. And I wanted to be prepared for the fact that I'd sit on that start line at the Olympic final and be so incredibly nervous. And so I wanted to practice being nervous. So I'd sit on the start line at a local regatta on Lake Burley Griffin. I'd try to work myself into this absolute tears of nerves of, you know, oh my gosh, this is such a big deal. It's so nervous, practice being nervous, you know, but pretend that there's butterflies there, all of that. The irony is that fast forward to the Olympic final, and that's actually the calmest I have ever been in my life. And the reason for that is that by the time you get to an Olympic final, when you have been ruthlessly transparent with yourself every step along the way, you sit there with the comfort of knowing there is nothing else you could have done. And you know that you've practiced this. It's like there's not many times in your life where you can actually say, I've spent the past 11 years focused on this one moment, and I know how I want to think, I know how I want to feel, I know what I want to hear, I know what I'm going to do. It's just all I have to do now is do what I've trained myself to do. So there was a real irony in that a lot of the time that preparation and that, you know, honesty within yourself, it's not what you, you know, pretend, oh, you know, I've ticked every box and I've done stuff. You know within your heart of hearts whether you've really done everything that you could do. And so that, you know, couple of minutes before the start of the Olympic final was strangely this sense of calmness that, you know, ever since then I would love to recreate, recreate that composure.
I would just quickly mention, because Kim is being a bit humble, she won the gold medal at the Rio Olympics. So, like, nailed it. The Power of Ruthless Accountability. Does anyone have a story they want to share? Maybe not along those veins. That was a pretty high bar. but in terms of that sense of accountability, I might throw to you if you don't mind, Catherine, because you're fairly new in the role that you're in now. And does that weigh on you too, like in terms of like driving that change and being accountable and creating that space where you say to your team, and particularly as a leader in a fairly new role, I am not perfect, I'm new to this too, and let's learn together and let's be on that journey together?
So I think the politically correct answer would be to say, yes, of course, it weighs heavily on me. But my honest answer is no, because I feel highly prepared for it, in that the organisation, when I joined, did a fantastic job of briefing me in, demonstrating where we were performing well, where there was risk, where they were really looking for guidance. And so that's, you know, that's kudos to their preparation. And then secondly, I'd say, you know, any of our businesses are about the quality of the people. I'm very lucky. I've got an excellent senior leadership team. My natural style is one of a team-based one. So, you know, I'm very forward-leaning on kind of sharing my thoughts. We discuss things. We unpack problems together. And so that decision-making process, whilst ultimately it sits with me, it is a team-based process. And I think that one, you know, gives assurance to them that their issues and concerns are being addressed, but also helps ensure that the decision I land at is one that is informed with the best available information at that point in time. And I think that's a good recipe for solid decision-making, essentially.
That's a really good way to put it. And the kind of the thread throughout all of that is kind of that sense of preparation from the both of you, but preparation ourselves individually, but the organisations as well. There's an element of sort of accountability from the organisations you work for that create that kind of environment, that culture.
Absolutely. And, you know, and I think it's about respect. You know, I walked in and the organisation had spent time and effort preparing, you know, the incoming director's briefing pack. And if I hadn't have read that, that's disrespectful to people's time and effort. And so I absolutely read it in the first week and then was asking questions and all those kinds of things that sort of flow from that. And I think firstly, there was kind of shock I had read it. And secondly, then kind of, you know, a kind of then excitement that we could actually, you know, accelerate a lot faster. So I'm 4 months into the job and I feel very comfortable about what we're doing and where we're going. And again, that's because the people in the organisation have prepared me well for that. But I've sought to give back, to give the commitment that the organisation is asking of the director. That doesn't mean I'm working 7 days a week, 24 hours, but it does mean that, you know, things land on me. I need to engage with it, I need to consult with people, and I need to give the organisation direction.
And I hope that's also really validating for any one of us who have been in an incoming government brief process or have the great privilege of doing one in the future, myself included. It's nice to know they're read, but it's also nice to know that they're powerful and they build a relationship with the leader that you're trying to influence. If I could shift our timeframes a little bit now into the present, and this question is for Nunu. Now, Nunu, what change are you currently trying to drive in your field or in your workplace?
So I might start that with a little bit of a touch in the past, if you'll indulge me.
That is absolutely fine.
So I remember coming back from DC and, you know, for anyone who's travelled in North America, especially some of these, you know, larger cities, it's a very multicultural place. And I was working at the World Bank, which is the most multicultural place you can work at in the world. And I remember coming back to Treasury and I was, you know, heading up a geoeconomic regional engagement area. And I suspect many people kind of, you know, understand this experience. And I was sitting in this meeting and we were talking about regional engagement. And I looked around the room and there were people from lots of places across government. And I was the only person of colour in that room. And we were talking about regional engagement. And also what struck me was there were no people who had a visible disability in this room. And if you look down all the names, there was a really, really large Anglo-Celtic dominance of names. So there was one, you know, continental European name in the list. And I went back and I thought, wow, this is such an adjustment from coming from the World Bank. And I remember that moment and going back to my desk and saying, right, as a treasury economist, what's the data say? You know, so as a Sorrell and Wilson scholar, and you know, we have this large focus on evidence-based policy. Much of my work is actually in tax and fiscal modelling, which unsurprisingly doesn't get much notice. But the thing that seems to have really captured people's imaginations is the paper that I've just put out. There's a working paper now on the ANU website. And what it does is estimate promotion probabilities for every level in the APS using 20 years of data. So every single person in the APS is in that data set. We model every single promotion ever given over the past 20 years. And we measure what the impact of being a woman, having a disability, and being of non-English speaking background on your promotion prospects. And that's controlling for skills, experience, being a graduate, being part of a central agency. So for me, I think what I've tried to do with that is bring some data, evidence, and science to our diversity discussions about, you know, is it true that, you know, people of non-English speaking backgrounds don't get promoted because perhaps there's a language barrier? Well, actually, it turns out not to be true, because even people who are born and raised here have decreasing probabilities of promotion as they ascend ranks. And it gets larger and larger. It's something like 60 to 70%. The English-speaking background staff has 60 or 70% higher probability of getting to SES to a comparable non-English-speaking background staff. Now, that probability is still something like 40% higher, even if the non-English-speaking background staff was born and raised here. So fluent English, culturally Australian, they're still not getting to SES. So one thing I've tried to do with that paper, at least, is to bring some evidence and science and data to our diversity discussions. We have the full set of results also for the Indigenous cohort in the APS, which are undergoing through the ethics approval process, as you have to do whenever you analyse Indigenous data. But for any people who are Indigenous First Nations, please reach out, because I can share those results with you. So that's, I think, a really important element of diversity and thinking about diversity, is actually to bring evidence to the game. Because only through evidence can you actually isolate the problems and, I guess, push against our biased expectations about why these outcomes are happening across the service.
Can I just make a comment there? But it's incredibly interesting to hear, because one of the things, and I suspect this isn't happening in government, but it's certainly happening more broadly across private sector, is the use of generative AI in recruitment scouting and recruitment decisions. And obviously, if that's using historical data, it would be inherently biased and be embedding, you know, decisions over many, many years, and make it even harder to see a better answer. So it would be incredibly, incredibly important.
That's a really good point. And the role of technology in leaning against biases is a really important one. But we also have to remember that the starting point is panels who might view someone who has a visible disability, who is coming through, you know, an affirmative action Indigenous program, or someone who looks like me. They may not see that person as a secretary. So we already have ingrained biases culturally and in our system, both through Australian culture but also through APS culture, right? And it is much easier to reprogram an algorithm than it is to reprogram people, right? So if I don't like what the algorithm is telling me, and I know it's harder with generative AI, but if I don't like what it's telling me, I can reprogram the parameters. With people, I must go through an enormous cultural change experience, right? And we've done that successfully. So my results show that women at every level started less likely to be promoted than men, but from 2012 onwards accelerated, so that now women at every level are just as likely to be promoted than men, and at EL2 and SES, more likely, right? So we've had this huge cultural change across the public service generally, we can do it. It takes about a decade, but I can reprogram AI in about a second.
Can I just jump in because I'm deep in the AI issue in a defence sense at the moment? Reprogramming the algorithm, great, but when you're working off data that is dated, biased and gives you false assumptions, it's really, really difficult. And I know the sort of the ethics of AI is the trendy thing at the moment, but it becomes very tangible in a defence military context. If you're thinking about how you take automated decision making and apply it to something that has a direct impact on someone as a personal entity, and putting humans in the loop on that is really hard, because if it's presenting something to you that is built off incorrect data, it's really difficult to know, because it's so ingrained in our technology at every step of the way. It's a very live challenge.
And this conversation is really important, because we've looked at technology and the pace of technology, and people are seizing it as a bit of a magic bullet to solve social and cultural problems. And that's clearly not the case, which is the point that Catherine pointed out. Nunu, this is the first time Nunu and I have met, but I said to her just before we started the podcast that as an Asian, a Chinese Australian from a non-English speaking background who arrived in this country after the age of six, her research really, really was like pushing on an open wound. But notwithstanding my personal takeaways, I think it's important to think about how we together reprogram APS culture to be more inclusive and diverse, but also how we make sure that machines do not do that for us, or do not pretend or claim to do that for us. Technology is not going to solve the problems that we have in the community. Technology is neither good nor evil or neutral. There are people who frame it, who control it, who train it, who bring together the data that it's based on. And I think it's really important that we can't stand back and allow these changes to make decisions for us, as Catherine said, because we are also the object of those decisions. So as leaders, we have to kind of seize the initiative to drive where progress takes us, and where progress takes us in the right positive pro-social directions that we have. And that is a huge responsibility, but it is an incredible opportunity for us in the national security community and in communities outside national security as well. So on the topic of AI and machines making decisions for us, I'm going to shift us into the future. And Catherine, this one is for you to start with. Are there any changes that you think the national security community or our audience or policymakers in general should be focusing on, in your view?
There's lots. I mean, I think one is, I said it earlier, you know, our business is all about people. So as part of our leadership role in any change environment, it's really about explaining the why, the purpose, what we're doing, and how the direction of travel we're going in is going to get us to that end state goal. But, you know, when I look at the business that I'm in at the moment, you know, geospatial intelligence, you know, geospatial is a boom industry at the moment. Every sort of second company that's being stood up at the moment seems to have geospatial intelligence offerings, and industry is growing. But just like it's done in sort of other int type businesses, and that really presents with us how we think about the nature of our business. You know, what is it that we do that is unique and special and can't be done by commercial partners? What is it about our business that requires particular skill sets, particular training, etc.? But ultimately, you know, when I think about broader national security objectives, it's a whole of country, whole of workforce effort. And if we can share the burden on delivering against that effort in a more seamless way, where we have mature, you know, strategic partnerships with industry on capability, on training, on workforce, on service delivery, and we're really just doing the things inside the classified environments that we absolutely have to do in that space and no one else can do it. But we've got that mobility between industry, academia, private sector, you know, broader governments and international partners. We should absolutely be looking to do that. So we've talked a lot as a community about mobility of workforce, diversifying our pipelines. You know, we need to keep doing all of that, but at some point we also need to fundamentally think, am I doing the thing that I need to be doing, or can someone else be doing that for me, and how can I build partnerships to deliver that outcome? I don't need to build the satellites, launch the satellites, collect all the data off the satellites, ingest it, analyze it, get it to customers. I don't need to do all of that. I've got partners that can do parts of that supply chain, but I absolutely need to do the bit where you're ingesting it, analyzing it, fusing it with other bits of intelligence, and then delivering it to customers for what I describe as decision advantage. And that could be the emergency response committee, because we help state and territory governments at bushfires. It could be the military, who are in theatre executing a military outcome. It could be the Prime Minister and around the NSC table, where they need to understand how to help evacuate non-combatants out of a conflict zone. Now, it could be a myriad of things. But if we think about an ecosystem of partnership, then we can force ourselves to rethink our business and what we fundamentally have to do inside the tent. I think we can change the nature of our relationships.
Can I just draw in our other two panellists on that, this ecosystem of partnerships? Because what Catherine was talking about is also ecosystem of partnerships, better with private sector and with academia. What's your view on how to grow that ecosystem?
So I'll touch on, I guess, the data issue that we're raising, right? So we've got this explosion of the growth in administrative data sets, right? And uplifting our capability to use and leverage that in all parts. And, you know, obviously I've leveraged HR data, but, you know, the other three chapters of my thesis, you know, access tax data, census, you know, it's this enormous growth of data, and it's understanding the appropriate ways to use that, to leverage that, the quality of the data. So there's always bias in the collection. So what fields do you collect? Right. Even the fact that we called the multicultural cohort in the public service non-English speaking background, even if they only speak English, just because their parents speak, you know, first language was a language other than English, the fact that we're the only Western economy not to pick up race as a variable, there's even a bias in the categories that we put out, you know. So starting from that, and having a partnership with academia to understand where the bias is in the whole chain of that collection and analysis and usage, and how it then feeds into broader complex systems, is a really important partnership to actually invest in.
Completely agree. I think there's a few elements to it. You know, having right business models, right partners, playing the right roles together. Is part of it. I think the other thing that's part of it is diverse teams make better decisions. And we do have a bias towards people with a lot of experience in a particular domain that makes it very hard for outsiders to come in and feel like they have a voice that is worth listening to on a particular problem. And one of the things that we often find is we'll have someone who's a 20-year specialist in a particular technology who's spent their life working in banking and mining, doing a particular thing, and we'll bring them across, get them cleared to solve a particular problem in the national security space, and they feel so underconfident. Even though what they actually bring is hugely beneficial. But getting to that point that we understand that approaching problems in different ways, and that's not just skills based, it's sort of different personalities, different backgrounds, different socioeconomic groups, bringing together a greater diversity and range of people always will produce a better decision-making result. So finding a way that there is a real safety and a real respect for people who may not feel a part of a particular group, I think is key as well.
Yeah, and that's so important no matter what sector or organisation or what role you're from. Now, if I could close with a final question for all of you, and this is sort of future casting. Could you comment on what lessons you've learned from your past efforts to make change? And essentially, what is your top tip for being an effective change maker? I might start with you, Catherine.
Sure. So I think effective change, explaining the why, why we're doing it, why do you need change, et cetera. I talk about having consistent and persistent messaging, so being absolutely consistent about what we're doing, why we're doing it, what we're working towards, and being annoyingly persistent and repetitive about it, because there's never too much comms. The third bit is kind of, I think someone on the panel said it earlier, accepting that you're never going to please 100% of the people. You know, that we are imperfect and not everyone is going to be happy, and we need to actually accept that. But change and improvement, sometimes it's transformational and sometimes it's just incremental and it takes time. So I think if you can kind of, you know, hit those three things, you're setting yourself up for success. And the final bit, which often doesn't get talked about much, but, you know, change, people often look to the leadership group to affect change. But actually the most effective change is when people are both from the ground up are driving it, your middle management are on board with it, and the leadership are setting the vision, and all three of those elements are aligned. So everyone has a role to play in affecting change, and taking ownership of your individual participation in that in a constructive way. I really encourage people to do that, and that's a leadership job, it's a management job, but it's also just being a member of the organisation that you're in. Change is constant, and sometimes it's small and slow, and sometimes it's big and fast, but ultimately we're all living through change all of the time. So I just encourage you to embrace it, accept it, know that it's never going to be perfect, but just ask your leadership why, and make sure that they're consistent about delivering and staying focused on that outcome.
Kim,
I love that. The change is constant, is, I think, the perfect message. And I think the other thing is it's also not one directional. So one of the things with how we bring ourselves into a particular team or into a particular context is we need the ability to change how we present ourselves and how we fit in depending on the team around us and depending on the needs of that particular situation. And the example I would give is I've chaired a finance, audit and risk committee for almost 8 years now. I've had various chairs and CEOs in that time. And if you've got a chair and a CEO who have a very high risk appetite, your job is, as part of that team and getting a better answer, is to bring your contribution in a way that brings balance. Likewise, when the chair changed to have a different risk appetite, there's a different way to fit into that scenario. And so I think the reality is, as the world changes around us, as the needs of our organisation changes, as our team changes, the people we work with, the people we work for, the people we work near, we also need to have the perception and the willingness to adapt to that, which is why we can never get it right. And we're always going to need to improve, because it's a constant thing of guessing, learning, iterating and trying to adapt to the scenarios that come before us.
I think I'd like to reflect on, you know, people say, well, I can't affect change because, you know, the system's doing this, or, you know, the structures are against me. But I love that idea of personal accountability, because you are the system, right? And you can make a big difference if you go back to your seat and take accountability for that one thing that you know will make your workplace and the service better, right? Because I think when I thought about change and, you know, whether or not to do this data analysis, write that paper, you know, turn up today, one of the issues is, well, if it's not going to be you, then who is it going to be, right? And why did you join the service? Did you join it to act with integrity, to be a steward, to leave the service and your workplace in a better position than which you found it when you entered? So if you take personal accountability for the change, you can affect large change. There is no such thing as a system because you are the system. So I think that's the message that I would like to leave.
That's a wonderfully motivational note to end on. Thank you, Nunu. You are the system, and I think a lot of us probably come into this community and into the work we do believing that the world is run by people who show up. So show up every day and every day after.
We'll be right back.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
In this disrupted world, Australia needs security professionals more than ever. Join the next generation studying at the ANU National Security College. Our programs uniquely fuse academic knowledge with practitioner experience and fit around your lifestyle with study offered online and on campus. Follow the link in the show notes for more information about programs and scholarships. The ANU National Security College. Engaging minds for a secure Australia.
Now, I have a couple of questions from our audience today. So the first question from one of the audience members comes from Afia Akond. Afia?
Hi. Thank you so much for this opportunity. My name is Afia Akond and I work at the Australian Strategic Policy Institute. And thank you so much to Nunu, Kim, Olivia and Catherine for sharing your insights and to National Security College for organising this podcast event. So my question is specifically around the topic of intersectionality in national security, especially with respect to the inclusion of women from culturally and linguistically diverse backgrounds. So as we've heard, the National Security College has been doing really fantastic work on cold representation, as evident through the podcast series earlier this year. And Nunu, congratulations on your working paper where you engage on this issue within the APS, with one key finding being around the difficulties faced by Asian Australians in promotion opportunities. So my question specifically for the panelists is, how can we ensure that women from culturally and linguistically diverse backgrounds are proportionally represented in senior leadership positions in national security? And noting some of the issues that the panelists have highlighted around AI in recruitment, what are some better strategies that could be instead used?
Thanks, Sophia, for that question. So I was heavily involved in the gender equity kind of movement that we had about a decade ago. And as part of that, you know, at Treasury, my team and I put out analysis that show that, you know, female grads were being promoted more slowly than male grads, you know, using, you know, this field called leadership, which was just a, you know, someone's expectation that someone had been doing a great leadership job. So it was kind of the fuzziest of all the measures. We also show that, you know, women who got promoted to higher ranks were just over that 10-year period were, you know, had top marks, you know, better marks than some of the men who were getting promoted. And as part of that, we moved to a female SCS target, which we have reached and exceeded. So I'm quite proud to have been part of that movement. And as I said, you know, my analysis shows that women are now equally likely to be promoted, you know, at every level compared to similar men. But that doesn't mean tools down. Why? Because that's public service-wide analysis. And anecdotally, in some of the kind of internationally oriented national security agencies, well, some of the women tell me that there's a bit of a dip at EL1 and EL2 level in terms of their promotion prospects. So maybe a little bit of analysis in relation to parts of the service where we still might have issues is warranted. And having said that as well, what does progress along this measure mean? Well, it means hanging on to the gains that we've made and going further, right? Because what it shows is that women who are culled and calm, so culturally and linguistically diverse or culturally and racially marginalized have been left behind in this. And so when I think back to some of the policies that we deployed, you know, as part of kind of equalizing kind of gender probabilities, it was the whole chain of events in a person's career. So we made sure that the intake was gender balanced. We made sure that we were looking at how workflows were allocated between men and women, because some of the feedback we'd gotten was that women were getting coordination tasks and men were getting the higher profile policy tasks that eventually led to high profile briefings. So they were kicking policy goals. Even though the graduates were getting in the door were very, very intelligent, very talented people, regardless of gender. And also, you know, it became an SES accountability to make sure that whenever there was a promotion or acting opportunity, every single person who was eligible had a go, actually put up their hand for that regardless of gender. So we started to, I guess, because we didn't know exactly where this was happening, we started to dismantle every bit of the chain, and then we entered mentorship and sponsorship, and then having high-profile women on our executive board, really accomplished, to give that kind of aspirational seeing someone like yourself in a position of power. And so when I think of that process, I think of, well, that's something, you know, from the gender movement, that's a template that we can use. Mm. And it's not just for culturally and linguistically diverse staff, but also for disability and also for Indigenous First Nations and other, you know, marginalised groups in the APS. So I really love that thought of taking what we did for gender and knowing that works and being able to expand that to help other cohorts.
We actually have a second question, sort of down a similar vein, from Mel Anotsky.
Hi, thanks for letting me ask this question. I'm from the Mosaic Project. So we're an APS-wide program looking to promote cultural and linguistic diversity within the APS and address barriers to representation. So Nunu, thank you for your work. My question's actually for Catherine. With Australia's tight labour market, many companies are focused on broadening their talent pipelines beyond applicant cohorts they've traditionally more easily attracted. Where do you see tangible opportunities for the national security community to attract and retain a broader range of culturally diverse staff as a way to address these workforce shortages and bring in new capabilities and perspectives?
Thanks very much for your question. And I suppose if I had an easy answer, we'd be there already. But for me, it really starts at the very beginning, which is, you know, the kind of visibility and attraction and people just getting to think about intelligence or national security as a career pipeline. So I talk about normalising it. So if you ask school kids what they're going to be, you know, fireys, doctors, lawyers, you know, accountants, etc., no one's saying to me, oh, I'm going to be an intelligence professional, except maybe my kids. But so for me, it really is how do we just normalise this as a career path? Because actually, if you take a step back and we talk about, you know, economic prosperity or national resilience or social cohesion, you know, all of those things have national security aspects to them. And so if we can think about, you know, having school kids go, yeah, you know, I want to work in national security, I want to support Australia's prosperity or Australia's security, and we can talk about it as a profession, I think that would be a first step. The second bit I would say is traditionally in our kind of targeting and recruitment, you know, we're pitching at a very particular type of graduate, you know, have you done international relations, do you have a language degree, etc. But really, this is my fifth intelligence agency in the community, and I can guarantee you it doesn't matter what you do or what you've studied, there is a job for you in the intelligence community that is fulfilling, exciting, and will give you huge opportunity throughout your career. But again, you know, whether or not it's a, you know, an accounting stream or a STEM type stream or, you know, the trade schools, we need to be out there and saying, you know, just because you're a locksmith doesn't mean you don't have a great career in the intelligence community. I can think of two agencies straight away that would love to have your skill set. So, you know, for me, it is one of just normalisation and saying, you know, there's a career path for you. So that's trying to get people thinking about them, get them in the door. I do think we've got lots of work we need to do around just the process. Once people even turn their mind to it, how they find out information, how they apply, what's actually involved in that process, and us and the intelligence community being very open and transparent about that, and some of the implications that flow from that, especially if we are talking about cowed communities. You know, what does it mean for someone with a background in terms of their future ability to travel to particular countries overseas once they hold a clearance, or you know, how they'll maintain relationships with family members that might still be in different countries. They're really important things to people's you know, lifestyle, who they are and how they identify. But we should absolutely be able to work with that and make people feel comfortable and being able to be authentic and, you know, their true selves in the workplace and get the benefit of that diversity of thought. If I think about if we did all of that and did it well, then it's really one of mobility, and kind of goes back to my answer earlier. That's not just mobility in the intelligence community. It's mobility with private sector, with industry, with academia, having a broader ecosystem of people that have worked in the intelligence community, have a security clearance of some type will only be of benefit. I talk a lot about having empathy for people. If you have worked in a particular agency, you have an innate understanding of the challenges that that organisation operates in. So the more mobility we have, I think, leads to greater empathy and greater decision making, because we can understand each other better. We understand where people are coming from. It might sound like a bit humanistic, but I genuinely believe if people moved more, worked more collaboratively together and were exposed to each other's challenges, be that a personal kind of background or a workplace, we're going to get a much better outcome, because we'll have a much greater depth of understanding and appreciation for not just the challenges people face, but the huge opportunity that working together presents. Within the intelligence community, we've done a lot to move to much more integrated teams, much more of a mission-based focus, but we've got a long way to go in terms of expanding that same approach out into how we think about employees, staff, and partnerships to help us achieve that mission.
That was a really comprehensive answer. And if I could just take a really quick plug for the National Security Podcast Cold Mini Series, Caroline mentioned that our next podcast is actually about vetting, and we drilled in a little bit more with actual vetting and clearance officers. And that importance of mainstreaming, of making the career path really relatable and setting those right expectations, that's a really strong foundation for growing the community. And heaven knows we need more intel analysts than we need TikTok influencers.
If I could just add one little note to that, what we found with the experience of gender equity is that targets work, right? So a target signals to the applicant that they are valued and they have a career path in that agency. And so if you're having a perception problem in your agency of culled staff not applying or even transferring from other places in the APS, you know, a target is a really good signal to say, you know, we're changing our processes to help you, and you will have a career path here.
I agree.
Our third question comes from Caroline Badal. Caroline, can I see you in the audience?
My name is Caroline. I'm from the Department of Prime Minister and Cabinet. I'm also a double master's student at ANU. I study in international relations and international law. My question is for Kim. As a mature woman, a woman and a more mature woman, how do you suggest breaking into a new career without being perceived or treated as a junior or a beginner?
It's a wonderful question, and I think something that Regardless of background, everyone has experienced that feeling of imposter syndrome at some time or another. I think there's two parts to my answer. One is around imposter syndrome, and something that I often say that imposter syndrome is a real privilege because it means you get prepared. So if you feel like you are something of an outsider, one, take comfort in the fact that everyone feels this, and two, take comfort in the fact that that nervousness and that anxiety actually helps you listen better, prepare better, ask better questions, to be able to play a valuable role. I think the other side of it is I'm a big believer that you don't need a job title or a label to be a leader and to make the lives of the people around you better. When I moved across to consulting, I was 32, I'd been a senior lawyer, I'd been to the Olympics, and I started consulting as an intern. So me and the 19-year-old still at uni. But that doesn't stop you bringing your whole self and solving the problems that are before you, treating people well, asking good questions and making the life easier for people around you. And I think that that's a real key to making a difference. It's not, I'm not of the camp of personal brand. I think it's more important to do the right thing than say the right thing. And the consistency of doing the right thing, I think, is incredibly important. I think it's something I have reflected on in this session of, is that harder for people who come from different backgrounds, who may not be noticed in the same way? And that's certainly something that I'm reflecting on, and how can we make sure that the people who are heads down doing the right thing get recognised and rewarded for their contributions in the way they bring themselves to work. But I think the main thing, if you do the right thing, good things will happen.
I would just sort of add, like Kim, I mean, I've been an outsider. So at the moment I work in defence and I don't wear a military uniform, and I've worked at the ACIC and I didn't wear a policing uniform. And when I went to one particular intelligence agency, I hadn't done a course 25 years ago, and so therefore I wasn't an intelligence officer, even though I'd like run operations with them. So being an outsider is actually normal. And if people will stop and reflect, if someone said to me, I've done the exact same job for the past 30 years, I would think they're really weird. It's sort of saying, it's a real privilege. Like, just because you haven't got that experience, you do have all these other things that you have done and proven and delivered, and that diversity of experience it is invaluable to an organisation, and organisations are increasingly looking for that diversity of background, because I don't want a senior executive team who all have the same lived experience, because that's actually counterproductive to what we need.
And our final question from the audience comes from Siobhan Madden.
Hi. Thank you for putting on such a great event today, and thank you to the ANU for all the support over the years, and to Dr. McCarthy and Dr. Carolyn Coelho through my studies. My question is, given the proliferation of serious armed conflicts in the world at present and serious and harmful disinformation, how important is social cohesion to stable societies, and what does social cohesion mean to you? Thanks.
Does anyone want to start with tackling that one? It's a big question.
I'll jump in and see how we go. Social cohesion, I think, is absolutely critical to not just Australia but to other countries. It's easy to look around the globe and say, the world's going to shit, basically. And from an intelligence perspective, there is a huge demand that attaches to that to that when that happens, and we are expected to respond and inform and give kind of, you know, decision advantage for our leadership. But that comes at a cost to organisations and to the people that work in those organisations. And so whether or not we're thinking about an offshore conflict or one that's closer to home, or even looking at, you know, the social divisions that come through really challenging questions that have been put to the nation, we really need to think about how do we ensure what we're doing has the social license and the social support of the citizens of the country. And that's a real challenge for the intelligence community. You know, we're not standing up every day talking about why we do what we do and what the intelligence is telling us. We can't do that. But we certainly have a role to play in informing the policies that are developed to both of, you know, anticipating what could be divisive, but also informing options that might help with some of the bringing together of the nation. And if we think about some of the geopolitical challenges that, you know, could happen over the next 5 or 10 years, you know, they will have impacts on us as a community, and how we have a conversation as a country about what actually unites us and what we hold dear and valuable and the benefit that our multicultural society brings to us, both from a workforce perspective, but also from the values of the liberal system that we seek to support and enable, which the intelligence community hold dear, to be honest, then we absolutely have a role to play. And I think only focusing offshore will be a detriment to the intelligence community and to the broader national security environment.
I think it's a wonderful answer, and I think there's so many layers to this. I mean, something that I often reflect on as a mother raising children is how much over time our sense of community has shifted in terms of how we live and how we link. So my dad comes from sheep and wheat country up in the Mallee, and the football and netball teams were the heart of that community, and that was, you know, where people went to be together and to be a part of something bigger than themselves. And I think increasingly we are getting caught in a bit of an individualist society that we're quite focused on, you know, achievement and possessions and things other than the people we're with and the community that we're a part of. And that's both from a social cohesion sense, but also the amount of research that's coming out around the biggest factor in longevity of life is actually the quality of our social relationships. And so thinking about how, you know, together we can better value, you know, who we are, how we relate, what we're a part of, and become closer together rather than further apart, despite whatever the world of online may be disrupting the way we relate to one another.
So I really love this idea of our multiculturalism as a strength. So we've become, you know, we're one of the most successful multicultural economies in the world, if not the most successful. And there's research out there that, you know, suggests that the results I found are not limited to the public sector. So we see it in the private sector and in academia. And for me, social cohesion isn't about ignoring our challenges, but understanding that multiculturalism is one of the best assets that Australia has, and making sure that, you know, we're pulling the best minds from all over the world in this country, and it's making sure that those best minds have the opportunity to be in the seats that they can make impactful decisions for the benefit of the community, and making sure that processes run in both the private, public and academia to make sure that that actually happens, so that we can really, you know, make the most out of, you know, what is, you know, one of the most diverse economies in the world.
Thank you so much, Nunu, and thank you so much to Kim and to Catherine. It's been a fantastic conversation covering the changes that we're witnessing and drawing together lessons from the past, the challenges we're facing now, and the changes that we want to shape and the change that we want to be, both socially, politically, in national security, in policy. Please join me in thanking our panelists today.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.